Today is October 15th, 2017. My name is Deborah Schwartz. I'm sitting here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, and I am pleased and honored to be sitting with one of Mill Valley's musical sons, Huey Lewis. Huey, thanks so much for sitting down with me today.
Very nice to be here.
You are quite well known in Mill Valley, certainly, and beyond. You are a musician, an actor. What other things are? Well, how do you see yourself?
Well, I don't really. I mean, that's your job, you know. I just do what I do. I was a songwriter kind of a little bit too. So, but you know, all those things. I mainly am a singer.
A singer. You're a singer.
Mainly.
You're a good singer too.
Mainly I'm a singer.
Yeah.
Harmonica player.
Yeah.
But mainly I'm a singer.
Well, you certainly embody a time in our Mill Valley's history. And as do many of your bandmates and the people that you've known over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And you're here in town today to perform in Mill Valley tonight, correct?
Exactly. We're going to perform downtown Mill Valley at Sweetwater. I just realized this morning that the last time I performed downtown was 1977, approximately, at the Old Mill Tavern. So that's how far I've come in 40 years. I've come from the Old Mill all the way down to the Sweetwater.
Yeah, and that's about less than a block.
No, that's a good couple. That's two blocks, I think. Well, yeah, block and a half.
Yeah, you've gone a whole block and a half in all these years.
Pretty
congratulations.
Good. Yeah.
Right back to the start in some ways. Because you grew up in Mill Valley, did you not?
Yeah. Well, I was actually born in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But we moved to Marin in 1955. I was 5 years old. And we lived in Tam Valley for a minute. First of all, we lived in the hotel, which is now the Peppermill, and my family did. While we shopped for a house,
mm-hmm.
My dad bought a house in Tam, or rented a house in Tam Valley, for about a year, and then we bought a house in Strawberry, and I grew up in Strawberry Point, which is in the Mill Valley School District, but it's not strictly in Mill Valley. It was across the freeway, across 101, which then was like 2-lane freeway.
Yeah. So in 1956,
yep,
there was some action going on in Mill Valley at the time. I interviewed Locke McCorkle, who owned the house where Jack Kerouac and
right.
Jerry Snyder and some of the Beat guys lived in Homestead.
Mm-hmm.
They had their life there. And
mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about what Mill Valley was like for you as a kid growing up. Your impressions, if you can remember.
Yeah, it was a very blue-collar place, you know. It was magnificent outdoor stuff. I mean, we fished and sailed and hunted and, it was so close to the city, and yet it was just a paradise to grow up in, you know, Marin County, Mill Valley. Mill Valley was just... I mean, it was on fire, but it was a very blue-collar place. There were hardware stores. There were no boutiques. There were no coffee places. Pat and Joe's was the only restaurant downtown Mill Valley, which would stay open all night. So later, when we'd have gigs, that's where everybody would meet after gigs. This was Pat and Joe's in Mill Valley.
Where in Mill Valley?
It was the bank right across, you know, in Litton Square right there, right just opposite parking lot from the... from the depot.
Oh, contiguous, right there.
Yeah, contiguous, right there. That bank.
Uh huh.
That was Pat and Joe's. Was a restaurant.
Huh.
Everybody will remember that. Anybody from that was the place in downtown Mill Valley, Pat and Joe's.
What was I mean, Mill Valley's changed quite a bit over the years. No one can deny.
Unrecognizable. It's absolutely unrecognizable.
What was the population about when you were?
I have no idea, but there wasn't very many people. You know, but I have no idea. No idea, but you know, it was a completely different place. Completely different place. It was just imagine. I live in Montana now, and where I live in Montana has more in common with the Mill Valley I knew than modern Mill Valley. It was a big influx, of course, during the in the 60s, when the Summer of Love, and then there was, remember, New Yorker Go Home, and all that kind of stuff. Remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was all that, and of course, who won? Well, boom, you know, now today, there's very few real local people around. A lot of people moved to Marin and Mill Valley in the 60s, even, mm-hmm. but you know, before 66 and 67, Mill Valley was a very blue-collar place, but a wonderful place to be brought to live.
What brought your parents here? May I ask the name of both your parents?
Yeah, my dad was Dr. Hugh Craig. He was a medical doctor, a radiologist, but also a jazz player. I love music and kind of a bohemian. My mother was an artist. Her name was Magda Craig, and she was Polish, born in Poland, escaped during the war, was a commercial artist in New York, real hot, and then got married, moved out here, and became one of the very first sort of beatnik, bohemian, going to hippie types, my mom. And, you know, that the appeal for them was they were both black sheep or bohemian types in their family, and he had been out here during the war, my dad, and he loved Europe. He'd been to Europe and Asia and all that stuff, and he was stationed in Alameda, and he saw the diversity here. You know, Marin County was very Bavarian. There were a lot of Europeans. Mm-hmm. The first Volkswagen joint ever was Elmer Fliegoff's Volkswagen dealer, a repair shop, and started what became Sonnen BMW. Elmer Fliegoff, I think, was his name. It was the very first BMW dealership, maybe in America, was right there in Marin County. And the mountain home on the mountain was a Bavarian style eatery, and Marin Joe's came when Romano came from Italy. And whose kids run the place today. So it was a lot of Europeans and a lot of kind of bohemian stuff. And my dad loved that, and so did my mom.
So they chose it for
chose
that
it.
Because they wanted that ambiance in
That's
their
it.
Town.
That's it. They wanted to live in a cool place like that.
So when you were growing up, who were your parents' friends?
A lot of doctors, because my dad was a doctor, but really interesting group, you know, and musicians. My dad hung out with musicians. He played drums with Ralph Sutton, who lived in Larkspur, ran the world's greatest jazz band, was an unbelievable piano player, and his kids and me were friends, and then my dad would have jam sessions in Mill Valley at the Outdoor Art and Garden Club. He would rent it for, like, nothing, whatever they charged on a Sunday, and my mom would make a big bunch of spaghetti and corn, and they'd have beer and wine, and he'd invite a bunch of musicians, and they would set up and have a jam session, and the kids would run around and blah blah blah, and they'd just play all afternoon and drink beer and eat spaghetti and drink red wine and eat spaghetti and jam. And that was Ralph Sutton, and Eddie Figueroa played bass. Byron Berry, the trumpet player. There was a real good cats, man. I worked with real great cats.
That sounds so fun, describing that.
Yeah. It was an amazing place to grow up. You know, it was a very bohemian community, all kinds of cool people around, and good restaurants for the first time and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Really, really good.
Did you play in these little jams? When did you started playing music?
No, I first started playing music when my parents got divorced. I guess I was 11, yeah, something like that. And my mom rented out a room to a guy called Billy Roberts, who wrote Hey Joe. And he was on the folk circuit, Billy Roberts was.
Would you sing just a little bit of that song for the people?
Hey Joe, where are you going with that gun in your hand? Hey Joe, you know, what was the story of Joe?
Jimi Hendrix sang that.
Well, Hendrix covered it.
Yeah.
But it was a folk song that Billy Roberts really wrote. And he had this, he sang, I think he got, somebody else pinched it, or he lost credit for it or something, but he always claimed he wrote the song, and I think he did. But that's his story, and we're sticking to it. But this was folk, you know, this was 62. this was, there wasn't any rock and roll. There was folk. I mean, there was rock and roll, but rock and roll was like 50s rock and roll at that time. There was, mm-hmm. this was the Bohemian scene was folk inspired, and that's who Billy Roberts was. And he had played acoustic guitar and had one of those harnesses, played harmonica in the harness, and had a bunch of harmonicas. And so he moved into the house as a boarder, and he gave me a bunch of old harmonicas.
So your mom was running out of room.
That's it.
And in comes this funky musician.
That's it.
And he gives you a harmonica.
That's it. That's it. That's exactly right. And then I started singing and playing harmonica. My dad, see, was a musician all the time and had drums set up and stuff, but he hated singers. He just liked big band jazz. Didn't hate singers, but he was into the big band. He was in the band, you know, and the thing. So I never heard the music he played around the house. There were never any singers. You know, it was just big band stuff. And then every once in a while, I'd hear Jimmy Rushing or a singer like in a band. I'd go, whoa, that's great.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of way I took, that's what I took for myself was the singing part.
So it just lit up a little something in you hearing that.
Yeah, I mean, I was in my body always, because my dad had played, even when my parents were together, he had a set of drums in the living room, and he would set me down on the drums and make me play time, and just swing, you know, swing time. He said, man, if you can play time, that's it, you know, that's what you got to do, you got to have time. And so, you know, I had been trained a little bit by my dad.
What do you mean by you got to have time? I don't know.
Time, rhythm, time, you got to be able to keep time. And be steady with it.
Like it has to be in you.
Yeah, you got to feel that. You got to feel that feel. Feel. If you do it good enough, if you're good enough, you can make it feel. You can make that thing swing and make it, and it feels great. And that's rhythm. That's time. You got to have time.
Yeah.
Time, you know, pitch and arguably music and stuff can be taught a little bit. But time has got to be in your blood, or so they say, you know.
Uh-huh.
But that was my dad's thing. So I always had time, although I was from Mill Valley. I went away to prep school. My parents divorced. My mother became this wild bohemian hippie. And my dad wanted to get me out of there. Was worried about me and all this stuff. And said, you know, you have an opportunity to go away to this private school. And so I did. I went away to prep school, and then I'd come back summers.
Well, you went to primary school. Which was your primary school?
Strawberry Point Elementary.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Edna McGuire,
mm-hmm.
which was junior high in those days. No, not one middle school. And then I went to summer school at TAM that summer. Took machine shop. Back in the day, they had machine shop. What a cool class that was.
Oh, yes. I've heard about the machine shop.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Like a trade school.
Yeah, that's it. And the high schools had that,
mm-hmm.
which is a great idea. I mean, TAM had a great machine shop. What a neat thing. And then I went away to prep school for 4 years at Lawrenceville School in Princeton, New Jersey. Lawrenceville, New Jersey, right next to Princeton. And I'd come home summers. But I had skipped second grade, so 67, I graduated from prep school. And I was going to go to Cornell. My father said, congratulations, you know, you graduate, but you're a year young. Only one thing I'm going to make you do. And then, as far as I'm concerned, all your decisions, you can do whatever you want. You're grown up. But one more thing. I said, what's that? He says, don't go to college. I said, what? He said, yet. I want you to take a year off and bum around Europe. I said, but Dad, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to play baseball. But nope. And he made me do that, and I took the harmonica, and I just played, you know, for a year. Busked my way through Europe, down North Africa, and just played harmonica. Then I went back.
So were you playing on the street, or you just played for yourself?
On the street. I'd sit in with some bands once in a while. I met a guy in Spain, American harmonica player in Spain, who was really good and taught me some stuff.
His name?
I can't remember. I don't know. Just how good was he? I don't know. I was learning, you know, just getting. He knew he was better than me. I learned some stuff from him. You know what I mean, kind of thing. I can't even remember now. So long ago, you know.
Yeah.
I was 16. You know, so, and in Spain. You know what I mean. So I had no clue. But I was playing every day, and I enjoyed it so much, and I actually paid my way. I could actually busk in Marrakesh. I could get 3 dirhams playing harmonica in the square. And it only cost me one dirham to stay in the youth hostel, and for another half a dirham I could eat all the food I wanted, and I was fine, you know. So I thought, hang on, and I had a dirham extra. This is working out, you know. So I went back to Cornell for 5 minutes over a 2-year period, played in bands, finally dropped out and came back to Marin, where it was now 1969, and you know, everything had happened. So I joined bands.
So you don't go to college. You are a student of the world.
Right.
You're bebopping around and paying your way with your harmonica.
That's it.
And then you come back and you enter into the summer of love and all that rock and roll. And many of the musicians by the early 70s that were living in San Francisco are now moving to Mill Valley.
Right, that's right. I had been, when I was in Europe, which was 67, 68, I represented the thing in San Francisco was on fire. It was Summer of Love. And I was in Spain, France, Greece. And so people were reading about it and hearing about it in Europe. And I personified that because I was, number one, a musician, and number two, came from San Francisco. I had the connection with that a little bit. You know, my mom was, you know, the first Deadhead. So I knew what was going on there. And so that was, I was sort of the first harbinger of that stuff, growing my hair long.
Yes, I wanted to ask you what you were wearing back then.
Yeah.
I like to get the picture of.
I can't remember
what was your.
Oh, it was kind of, you know, very hippy dippy stuff. I mean, I had like a leather beaded thing, you know, bracelets and some stuff, and then like a work shirt, these work shirts and like that.
Open.
I can't remember. So it depends on how hot it was.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was open or not.
Your mother really interests me.
Yeah, my mom is the most interesting member of our family. She was, you know, her story is amazing, but very, very long and complicated.
Yeah. So, but you do, because she later remarried to, right?
Yeah. They never married. They cohabitated, Lou Welch, the beat poet, mm-hmm. and my mother. Yeah. They met early on, and then she bought a house in Marin City. She said she's going to reintegrate, you know. A white family's going to move back into. So we lived in Marin City for a while, which is wild. I was away at prep school, and summers I'd come home, Marin City. And it was, and you know, summer love, Marin City. And Lou, the beat poet, with a living room full of poets and drinking red wine and smoking pot and taking turns reciting poetry around the coffee table, right? And amazing stuff. I mean, really, some, you know, Allen Ginsberg and the people who sat around the coffee table were amazing. You know, Creeley and Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen and Lou Welch and all the poets, you know, mm-hmm. and musicians, John Handy, and my mom dated Charlie Mingus for a while, you know, and that kind of stuff. So before Lou, you know, I wake up one morning and there's Dizzy Gillespie, you know, at home. Dizzy is, mom brought him home, Dizzy, you know, pretty cool.
Do you have siblings?
I have one brother who's a great drummer. It was an organ.
Well, this is a very California experience you're describing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very California for sure.
So you come back in the late 60s and you've got your harmonica thing down. And you got the time, too, right? You got your time.
Well, now I go to Cornell and I played in bands at Cornell till 70, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Something like that, till 70. Then I go back to come back to Marin, Mill Valley, and I meet the. What became parts of Clover, which was the Hereford Heartstrings. We were a bluegrass band, big bluegrass band. I started playing harp with them. And we would go to Ghirardelli Square, and we had a 10-piece bluegrass band. It was really pretty cool. We had a couple fiddles, harmonica, stand-up bass, two guitars, you know, Dobros, and that was and the core of that band was Clover, and then who had been signed by Fantasy Records, made records, so they asked me to join Clover in probably 72 maybe, and then I was with Clover all the way through till 77.
And the band members of Clover at that time were
Alex Call, John McPhee, John Ciambotti, and Mitch Howey. Mm-hmm. And then I and Sean Hopper, who now plays with me still, joined at the same time.
And that is when I met you so many years ago.
That's right. That's when we met.
You were playing in Clover.
And then Clover was when we tried every which way to try to get a record deal, and we couldn't make it happen. We finally got signed by Jake Riviera and Dave Robinson, two managers who decided to go partners on us. Jake had managed was managing Elvis Costello, and Dave was managing Graham Parker in The Rumor, and Jake was managing Nick Lowe, and together they went partners on Clover. And we flew to Britain, made two records there that just, you know, and toured extensively, but nothing, but, you know, never had a hit. Came close, but no.
I remember seeing you a couple of years ago. We saw each other at the health food store, and I recall when I was 18 helping you guys get to a gig.
Right.
There was no bus or anything.
This was probably in Fresno, right?
In Fresno, yes.
Yeah. And that was called, I know the gig, I think. Is it called the, I can't remember the room. It's not the Wild Blue Yonder, is it?
There was a Wild Blue Yonder.
Was there? Then that's
I don't remember
it.
Where the gig was. I just remember trying to put instruments in my Carmen Ghia at the time. And anyway, we were talking about this a couple of years ago, and to my astonishment, you remembered every name of the venues in Fresno, which I've long forgotten.
Yeah, I don't remember them anymore. I don't remember any of the places I play anymore. But those are formative times. My lights were on back then. I mean, you had to be, you know, we were trying to make a living, and trying to make a living. You know, and when you think back to those times, when our band, you know, we came from the 60s. We were friends first. We didn't, you know, we came from Marin County. I mean, Sean is from Sausalito. Billy's from Mill Valley. Mario's from Mill Valley. Johnny had moved. Johnny's from Fairfield, but he was living in Mill Valley. And I'm from Strawberry Point. I mean, we were a very, very local band. We didn't answer ads in newspapers or music papers or any of that stuff. This was our thing. And we had to figure out a way to compete and make it in a radio world. Because people forget, but in those days, it's late 70s, there was no internet. There was no FM radio, which had started in the 60s as with anything and everything, by the late 70s, was programmed. Top 40 radio Top 40 radio was invented with the advent of push button radio. Push button radio spawned top 40 playlists because now programmers reckoned that if you played, as long as you didn't play something they didn't want to hear, the public wouldn't change the dial. But now if they heard something they didn't like, they can immediately switch to another station. So the idea would be narrow your playlist and play the same hits over and over and over again. And that became top 40 radio. And that by the late 70s and 80s, it was called CHR, Contemporary Hit Radio. And all the AM stations, but by now the FM stations, which were the business, were all programmed. There was no more K-San playing hippy-dippy stuff. It was all programmed. So if you wanted to exist as a band, you had to have a hit record on a CHR format. Period. There was MTV had just started, and MTV show their playlist mirrored Radio and Records' playlist exactly. The number one record on the radio got the number one showing on MTV videos. That's why there's so many of those cringeworthy videos that you would see over and over and over again. You think, why are they doing that? Because the song was a smash. And so it was a radio world, and you had to figure out how to make a hit record
You had to penetrate that barrier.
That's it. And so...
So everybody was looking for that song.
Yeah, you had to do that. And so we figured out how to do that ourselves. We wanted to make those decisions ourselves. And we didn't want to have to go to L.A. to do that. We wanted to do that in Marin County. And we wanted to make all those decisions ourselves. Because we knew if we were going to flirt with that kind of commercialism, which we needed to do, that we didn't want to be, if we're going to have to sing this song for 20 years, we want to like it at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, and we did that. We produced our sports album and aimed every track right at radio, six of them, and we knew we needed a hit to exist. We didn't know we were going to have six of them, but we knew we needed one. And so, that's what we did. And now you listen to sports album, which was our, 83, came released in 83, and it sounds like a record of its time, a collection of singles. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of world it was.
Did you record that at the plant?
Yeah, we cut tracks at Fantasy and the plant and the Automat, as I recall, in San Francisco, and Studio D probably too in Sausalito. But Record Plant, Studio D, Fantasy, the Automat in San Francisco. Yeah, that was before we had this place.
Living here in Mill Valley now, people that have moved here recently would not know of the history of recording studios that was in Marin County.
Right. There used to be a lot of live gigs, and that's it. I mean, that's the thing we're proudest of, because in those days, if you wanted to enter, to compete in that radio format, you had to get a known producer with a track record, a guy with a track record, and the record labels were, and the only reason we got away with this is because we were signed to a British label, private British label, Chrysalis Records, and Chris Wright, frankly, and Terry Ellis were in no position, health-wise, to worry about what we were doing 6,000 miles away. And our manager fought for us, so we got to produce our own stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed out of L.A. We did it all right here in Marin. We wrote most of the songs ourselves, produced them ourselves, shot the album cover ourselves, did the and handed it to them. And so we've always been a Northern California band, And we wanted that to emerge.
I think that's why so many people in Mill Valley are so connected to your band.
We shot the cover at 2 a.m. Club. The other thing we did at the Ocean Beach with our first video, which was out, we just would go goof around on the sewage pier and mm-hmm. at Ocean Beach because it looked, and we walked down every side of Portrayal Hill for our videos. Everything was wanted to read Northern California, Bay Area.
So were you living in Mill Valley again then?
Yeah.
Where were you living?
Well, actually, I was living in Santa Venetia at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Larkspur, and then I moved to Ross, and then Kentfield.
And when you were doing the recording and all that, were you in the company of other musicians that were also making their own music in Mill Valley? I mean, there was Prune Music.
Right.
Where people would go hang
sure,
out. You used to go there?
Sure. Yeah, and there were gigs, right?
Mm-hmm.
On any given Friday, Saturday night back in the day, and I'm talking about 75 now, 1975, there'd be five places that had live music in them. There was River City. Before River City, it was Sleeping Lady Cafe, maybe, or something in Fairfax. There was always a gig in Fairfax. Then the little Mexican restaurant halfway to San Anselmo was a gig at one point. That was... oh, gosh, I can't remember the name of that place, but that was a gig. And then you go down into San Rafael. There was always New George's, used to be called, can't remember what it was called, but it was always a gig.
The Lions.
There was the Lions Share, and it was a big gig. Mm-hmm. Then there was the New George's, whatever that used to be called.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the gig Scoreboard on the other side of the freeway right there on 4th Avenue that was a happening gig. Then there was, Uncle Charlie's, and there was a gig in Sausalito somewhere? Yeah, there was. And I'd get it in a moment. But point being, there were live shows everywhere in Marin County.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. The Old Mill Tavern was a gig. Sweetwater was a gig before it was where it was at. There was a gig there. You know, we played all those places.
And who'd you play with?
Well, Clover played. It's interesting. We play the Lion's Share. Lion's Share's we played with Clover, and then the scoreboard we played with Clover. I played with Clover, and that gig in Mill Valley, Brown's Hall. We played with Clover in Mill Valley.
Old Brown's store. Brown's Hall.
Brown's Hall.
Yeah.
With Clover, and then we played. All those mostly with Clover. Clover's last gig was in Mill Valley at the theater right across from the old Sweetwater. What's that?
Throckmorton Theater.
Yeah, Throckmorton Theater. That was our last, Clover's last ever gig.
And that was what year?
1977, maybe. Something like that. And Jambody famously mooned the audience, maybe on our last song. He's not with us anymore, so I can say that. But he literally dropped his trousers and mooned the audience. And that was the last.
And he did that.
That was the last Clover ever did. I don't know. It was maybe. It was like he was mooning the world. It was like the last. It was the last Clover thing. I mean, Clover was just ill-fated from day one. You know, wow. We never could get it right somehow.
I hear that some of the songs are being used for a cable show now.
No, what's happened is John McPhee has re-recorded. And maybe you might want to interview Alex Call because he wrote all the Clover songs, and John McPhee has re-recorded his favorite tunes, what are probably unanimously Alex's Clover's best songs, only a couple of which were during mine and Sean's time. And he's re-recorded and played all the instruments himself. And then he got Mitch to play drums and Alex to sing. And it's been a long, long project. He's been at it for years. But it sounds amazing. It's amazing. And because McPhee, you know, is one of the amazing musicians in the world. I mean, he's really one of the tip-top great musicians on the planet, you know. And he's a wonderful guy, you know, John McPhee. Wonderful guy.
Yeah. That sounds good.
And it has a lot of Marin County history.
Mm-hmm. I'll get his info from you later. So now you're playing gigs. You've got your hits, and you breach the barrier. You're now on the radio.
Right. And we hit it like 12. Right. All of a sudden, oh my gosh! Now it's everywhere. And it's boom. And the videos. We had to ask them to not release Walking on a Thin Line as a single, or did we? Or Back in Time? No, you can't have it as a single. Why? Because we'd had so many singles in a row that we're afraid that we could see they're going to burn us out, you know. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's what happened, you know, a little bit. Then we had but creatively, we made a deal with ourselves that we would only, now that we were, you know, selling out big places and we could pay the bills, we agreed, made a deal to only do things for creative reasons. And so the next album was Small World, where we kind of stretch out a little. It was a little jazzier. Hired some, experimented with some percussion stuff, and we got Stan Getz on a song on the title track, which was just an unbelievable experience, man. Well, you know, the whole album was worth it for having him blow on this tune that is to this day the best probably 3 minutes of music that we've ever produced, mainly because Stan is blowing over it. But and that record was awarded Rolling Stone's worst album of the year that year.
Congratulations.
And it was our best stuff. And I went, wow, that's weird. You know. Was it our
best? Did that hurt?
Musically, what?
Did that hurt?
Yeah, absolutely, it hurt. Sure.
Rolling Stone is very influential.
Absolutely, that was the end of the love affair. I mean, we were on the cover of Rolling Stone twice, but that was the end of the deal, and I suddenly wasn't cool. Hip to be square was the joke nobody got, and we were overexposed, and now we just weren't cool, you know. But we stuck to our guns for the most part and did creative stuff. You know, didn't do Dancing with Stars, didn't chase the, or
you're pretty fit. What? You're pretty fit, from what I can tell. Don't discount that yet.
Oh, no, no. I literally do things for creative reasons.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
And that has served us well.
When you're talking about this, the minimal amount of experience and exposure I've had to the musical world, that is truly the most difficult thing, to maintain your creative control of what you want to do versus how you're being packaged and promoted.
Yeah. There's 100 people who have good ideas for us to do a Christmas album. Mm. Well, now why would a guy do a Christmas album? Is it because you have a version of Jingle Bell Rock in mind that nobody's done yet, or do you have something to lend to Little Drummer Boy that hasn't happened yet? Or I mean, you know, why do you do a Christmas album? Right? Money. I mean, so why do that? I don't. How uncreative can that be? Or other things, you know, cover this or that or your favorites or whatever.
I guess it's a don't forget me impulse. You keep yourself out there.
I guess. Yeah, no, I guess there is that. But I have a life. You know, we have lives. And lives are important things to have.
They are.
If you have a life, then you're not so worried about your career all the time.
Let us do talk a little bit about your life, because you're a father as well as a musician.
I am. I'm a father and yeah.
And your children, I recall you raising your children in the Marin County.
In Marin, yeah.
Yeah?
Mm, yeah.
So what are your children's names? How old
Kelly and Austin, and Kelly's married to a lovely guy named Ferdinand, lives in London. He works for, he's a finance guy, and they're extremely happy working on a family. And then my son Austin is working for Jimmy Kimmel. He's a social media guy at the Jimmy Kimmel show.
So that's how you got on the Jimmy Kimmel show, huh?
Yeah, no, Kimmel oddly enough has been a fan. I mean, he's been a fan since he was a kid. Mm-hmm. We were his favorite band growing up, and he is a unbelievably sincere, wonderful guy, right? Who you'd never met in show business in your life. I mean, nobody's like this. Nobody. I'm honest. I mean, there are people who are sweet in our business. Really, artists are generally very sweet, but you know, but genuine, Kimmel, and generous, and what's the word? Sensitive, and you know, and he's unbelievable. He's an unbelievable guy. And so we become friends. He fishes. He fly fishes. Authentic is a good word. Mm-hmm. That's really. So he comes up and visits me. I live in Montana now, and and we fish together. So we're fishing pals.
Looking back on how things sort of evolved for you. First of all, I want to ask you, the guy that taught you the harmonica,
right,
musician, did he ever play with you?
Billy Roberts. Oh, no, the kid in
Spain? The guy that lived in your mom's house.
Yeah, no. I saw him afterwards, and we acknowledged that, all that, got all that done. But I don't know where he is. I think he must be still alive, because he wasn't much older than, well, he was older than me. But, you know, I think he must be alive and out there somewhere. Yeah. He was from somewhere in the South, and he was just wandering. You know, San Francisco was a magnet for the folk musicians and stuff. And that's how the Jefferson Airplane started, as a folk band, you know. And all, you know, in the 60s, a lot of people moved to Marin. Mm-hmm. And then Mill Valley became home for a lot of illustrious people. But before 1967, it was just, you know, Bob Greenwood, you did that story, right?
Yes, Bob Greenwood.
That's really important, because George Duke and Bill Champlin, and there was that came from Mill Valley. And Mill Valley had a wonderful musical component because of Bob Greenwood, the musical teacher at TAM, and because they had a black population, an African-American population, who were schooled in church and gospel music. Those two things came together in Tamil Pius High School. And that's where Bill Champlin, that's where George Duke and Bill Champlin and Bill Gibson, our drummer, and Mario Cipollina and all the Cipollina, that's where all that came from. And really before the 60s, you know, that was, and Rob Moitoza, Opposite Sex, yeah. Six, and the Chord Lords, and those, there were 50s bands in Marin and Mill Valley that were really good. The Sticks, there were the Sticks and Butch Engel and the Sticks. And those were when I was a kid, when I was 12 and just starting the harmonic stuff. That's who I was looking up to, you know.
Did you ever play with Bill Champlin or Rob?
Yeah, well, many times. With Champlin, a lot, because since that time. Mm-hmm. Champlin, we went on the road with Chicago mm-hmm. when Champlin was in Chicago, and Bill sat in with us every night.
Yeah.
He was awesome. We love Bill Champlin. Bill Champlin is our hero. He is. He's really, we're like sort of the younger brothers of those guys, you know, in mm-hmm. a way. But Champlin was our hero, man, always. He's so good.
Yeah, he's a wonderful man. He's a friend, and he's been interviewed, and he's came and spoke
and
at
he's
the
flat
Mill Valley
talented.
Library.
He came what?
He spoke at the library.
I know he did. And yeah. At Throckmorton?
At the Mill Valley Library.
Oh, I thought he did a Throckmorton Theater thing, too.
Well, he did perform.
He did also, right?
He performed.
In Throckmorton?
Yes. He performed at a gala event that he...
But he did an interview, didn't he, with Joan Ryan or somebody?
Oh, perhaps. I don't know. Yeah. I interviewed him as well.
You interviewed him a little, but not in a public forum?
No, not at a Q&A, in a public forum. But he did speak at the Mill Valley Historical Society has a first Wednesday speaker series. And Bill and his wife, Tamara, came to Mill Valley, came to visit our house where he used to practice his band with the Moitoza family.
Yeah.
And then he gave a presentation, and Mr. Bob Greenwood was in the front row.
Came, right.
Yes,
okay,
up right
so that's
up front.
The event
and
I
he
heard
really
about.
Built.
I wanted to be there, but that,
that's right.
Sure,
you
we talked.
Right, yes,
I couldn't make.
But Bill has always been very devoted to the Greenwood family and attributes his success as a professional musician to Bob Greenwood.
Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
And
stayed close for many, many years.
Huh?
And
he had an influence on maybe now as a kid. There's a Tam rally mm-hmm. for a football game, and there's Champlin with. He's the only white guy in a 6-piece R&B band playing music for the thing, doing Ray Charles stuff. And I go, yeah, yeah, baby. You know, I said, and that was just like a light went on. I said, wow, how about that?
You guys kind of remind me of each other.
Really?
Uh-huh.
We have the same accent. You know, there's a Marin County accent, right? I mean, there really is. You can hear it. You can absolutely hear it. I mean, and people who come from other places and live here don't have it. It's interesting when you go in London, right? Accents go from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Right, they're dialects.
Because they're so old and so steeped. And for those of us who've been really from Mill Valley from the 50s, who really grew up here, there's an accent.
Yeah.
And I can hear it. I can't define it. It's part of a general California accent, and more specific Northern California accent, but even more specifically, there literally is a Marin County accent.
I think accent. You're called Millbillies.
Millbillies,
there's a t-shirt.
Huh?
Millbillies, there's a t-shirt.
Is there?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, we've got a band, Dory Collar and the Millbillies.
That's interesting.
They're very good.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of place it was back in the day.
Well, so when you come back and now you still have maintained creative control of your music,
right.
And you're living in the county, do you have a sense of being at home? How is it for you living in Mill Valley, growing up now? It's not just, I mean, you're grown, right?
Right.
I should say. So you're an adult. You're not getting up in the morning and seeing any number of Bohemians on the couch. You're in your own home with your own Bohemian friends or whomever.
Well, the honest truth is, I began to live more in a bubble, you know, because I had kids and I worry about the kids. So we moved to a place that had great schools and the kids, and our lives centered around trying to raise these kids in these. And me on the road and blah blah blah, and so it was just really family stuff. I would, you know, and I'd be on the road so much that when I go home, all I want to do is hang out with the fam, you know, mm-hmm. go out to dinner maybe, period or not.
Your ex-wife's name?
Sydney.
Yes.
And so, you know, we're really in our own bubble at mm-hmm. that point. You know what I mean? So I didn't have a sense of being. Connected. And Marin County was now changing, like, rapidly around us, you know. I mean, becoming more crowded and more anxious in a way and more urban, you know. And, you know, and it's coupled that now I'm at Pete's and I'm kind of wandering around 7:30 in the morning at Pete's to get my coffee, which I do now. And now this is the first thing I do, what you know, as I go to Pete's Coffee or whatever to get the Pete. And now I'm kind of daydreaming because it's early. I'm not up yet, and I'm kind of driving slow. Well, I hear a big honk on the horn, and this lady shaking her fist at me like I'm like races around me and goes, and her bumper sticker says, "Practice random acts of kindness and senseless acts of beauty," or you know that one.
Yeah.
I thought, this is Marin now, you know. So I gotta tell you, when you go and you come back and you go and you come back, it's tough, man. It's hard to come back to Marin and look at what it's become. It's very hard for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I still like it, and I love the rest. There's great restaurants, and I have people that I know, but wow, the quality of life just isn't here like it was when we were kids, man. When we grew up here, it was paradise.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a band that you played with that I want to talk about because I am a huge fan. And I know that you did a fundraiser, I believe, with it. But you've played with the Rock of Ages.
Oh.
The Redwoods.
Oh, yeah, you better have. Yeah, they're great.
Let's talk about them.
Okay.
Was it last year that you were in a...
Well, and I also...
not everybody knows about the Rock of Ages.
Well, the Rock of Ages is the vocal band from the Redwoods, the retirement facility. And they're a kick. I mean, they're really great. And we did a benefit for the Redwoods, and they opened up for us, and it was really pretty cool.
I think their oldest member is over 100.
Yeah,
and the youngest is what?
80? Well, probably. We also shot a video there that's yet to be released. For a new song, which is going to be released next year. We actually have an album going to come out next year, believe it or not. And it's a video that we filmed at the retirement center for my sort of almost coinciding with my mother's 90th birthday.
Because she's song, living at the Redwoods.
She was living at the Redwoods. And the song is called "While We're Young." And the chorus at one point says, let's go out and have some fun while we're young. Let's not wait till we're 91. And so it's a mythical 90th birthday party at the Redwoods for my mother, which in fact it kind of was. So we staged this thing, we filmed it. And then and the Rock of Ages people were our actors in our play. And I asked them, imagine you'd showed up for this event and there was a band there. And now you're really disappointed. You hate the fact that there's a band there. But during the song, they sort of warm up to us and eventually have a great time, get up and dance and so on. So we shot this whole video for the day. And these people had to be, and I told them we'd shoot it and reshoot it and shoot it and reshoot it. I mean, we were there for 10 hours, 12 hours. They were unbelievably productive. They and attentive and sweet and patient and... they were fantastic. The best actors I've ever... And they would, you know, they were really, really cute. It was really sweet.
There's something... Every time I hear them play, I cry a little because when they... The lyrics of songs change when sung by people that are at that late stage of life.
Sure.
Somehow they seem more profound and poignant.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm starting to feel it now, man. I mean, you know, we just lost Tom Petty. He's younger than I am.
Yes.
Tom Petty's younger than I am. I mean,
That hurt.
Oh, man. I mean, we're losing people. Glenn Frey was a pal, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we lost him the year before last, so, or last year, rather. So, you know, staying alive is part of it now. You know, and mortality's staring you in the face.
Does it affect you in your music?
Yeah. Yeah.
In what ways?
Well, you know, I mean, drink the good wine now, you know. I mean, if there's stuff that you want to do it. I mean, you know, and we have this record that we're been working on forever, but we're finally going to get that out, and that'll be our sort of probably final swing at it, you know what I mean? And then we'll just, you know, smell the roses a little bit, I think. Slow it down a little bit, take it a little bit easy.
Well, you've already moved to Montana.
Right.
How long have you been there?
Well, I've owned the place for 30 years now, but we just moved there when my wife and I split up probably 13 years ago, something like that, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I moved there permanently, and I love it. Although I come back here, you know, we still work here, and we have our place here that we make our records here and do our business here and rehearse here.
Because I'm sitting in the studio right now. Right. We're talking in the sound studio.
That's it.
And out in the other room,
it's not very glamorous, but it works.
Well, I think it looks pretty much like you imagine every sound studio would look, that has a really funky couch.
Yeah.
And nothing's in order.
Yeah, that's right. That's a fun part, you know. We do all this ourselves, so it's way more fun that way. It's the way we work, and you know, we've just done it ourselves for so long that I don't think we could conventionally make a record with a regular producer or any of that stuff. You know, we're just so opinionated anymore. It would be impossible for somebody to come in here and say, "This is what we're gonna do." We go, "Okay, yeah, right." I got an idea.
Well, at least you can fight successfully amongst yourself with your creative ideas.
And we know each other, you know, so I know, now Johnny may have a word, you know, if there's something to be said.
Sounds like a marriage.
Yeah, no, that people always say that with a band, right? Because as long, this will be our, 39th year together, something, 38, 39 years, you know?
And aren't we coming up to the anniversary of your first Huey Lewis in the News?
Our first record came out in 80.
80.
So it's really 37, it's coming up 38 years since our record came out. But we were, you know, it took us a year and a half to get the record, get the band together and get the record. So
How many years? Huh? 30, you said 37, 38?
No, January will be the 38th year since our first record came out.
Oh, you're so old now.
I know.
But you look the same.
Yeah, let's go with that. But the point is,
you've worked it out.
People say, "Are you still friends?" It's ridiculous. Of course, I mean, friends doesn't even begin to describe it. Or are you like family? No, no, no. You're not. You don't spend this much time with your brother. You just don't. Swear to God. You know, so, I mean, generally bands like ours, when you spend this much time together and you're still doing as many dates as we're doing, you work together, you're just fine. And when the date stops, see ya. You don't speak to one another, you don't see one another, nothing. Why would you? You know, we have more time together than any family or anybody. Husbands and wives don't spend this much time together. Why would they?
You're funny.
Except that we have to. We have to go from plan A, you know, gig A to gig B and travel on a bus together.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Looking back on your long, expansive career, any regrets?
Oh, any regrets? Yeah, probably. I wish I would have written Hip to Be Square in the third person like I originally wrote it. You know, he used to be a renegade. He used to fool around. He couldn't take the punch. I was trying to articulate a phenomenon that was of the 80s. Which is the same thing that, you know, David Brooks's book, Bobos in Paradise, articulates, was people dropping back in. It's Hip to Be Square.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I meant it as a gag.
First thing.
I didn't see what's going on. It's Hip to Be Square,
yes.
You know.
Uh-huh.
But people thought it was some anthem for square people. And, you know, and I got, because I thought it would be funnier if I told it on myself, right?
Uh-huh.
Because that's what's going on. People were sobering up a little bit, you know, and getting it to do it. That, you know. But that was a mistake in retrospect,
yeah.
You know. And people thought I was trying to write some anthem for square people, you know. But that passed after 15 or 20 years.
Any others? Any wish you could redo?
We flirted with Coca-Cola for an ad, okay? So... You know, this was before any musicians had done any ads or invited any kind of corporate involvement into their careers. We just didn't do that. Nobody did that. The Doors never did an ad. You know, nobody did any ads. And so suddenly, Pepsi signed Michael Jackson. And he did that Pepsi ad. Well, Coca-Cola hit the decks, and we popped out. And so they contacted my manager, Bob Brown, said, how would you like to do a Coca-Cola? And Bob told me, he said, look, you know, I don't know that if we ever want to do any corporate stuff, you know, but if we ever did, this is the call we ought to take. This is Coca-Cola. They own Columbia Records, you know, Columbia Pictures. And Coca-Cola, boom. So we took a meeting in Atlanta and flirted with an amazing deal, huge money, and said no for some reason. And I think we should have said yes. You want to know the truth?
Mm-hmm.
We said no because we had integrity and we didn't care. And we were just had hit it and our star had risen and we were selling out venues and everything was great. We turned down millions of dollars. That we probably should have taken. And not only that, it would have also branded us as a larger act down the line and all that stuff. But I was so nervous about that, the corporate thing. And I always have been. You know, I've never really done anything for commercial reasons other than the way we produced our sports album, as I said, you know.
That's something that might be hard for young people to hear today, that you would hesitate. But back then,
right.
There was definitely a stigma to going selling out to the man.
Exactly. Exactly. And the people I admired didn't do that. Still don't, really. You know, I mean, you know, Bill Champlin never did any ads. I just want to be Bill Champlin.
I think when he was in his early band, they did a little ditty for a commercial.
Which one? Sons?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah, he sings it in his in the first Wednesday. The people that were singing in the ad were in the audience, and everybody sang it.
Funny.
Yeah, it was very funny. Any other regrets? Lessons learned.
I think that's it. Let me think. Oh, early on. Well, no. I really don't have any other regrets. You know, there are a few nights I can't remember that I wish I could remember. I don't mean, not that I could remember, you know. I could have behaved myself a little better. Can we say that? You know, I could have behaved
nice
myself
and polite.
A little better. And if had I probably would have enjoyed everything a little better, but I did enjoy her. I remember specifically realizing, because you know I had been in Clover and Clover had had a tickle with success and it hadn't happened, but I'd certainly seen a lot, and I'd seen Thin Lizzy, who Phil Lynott took a liking to me and let me play on his solo stuff and played a jam with Thin Lizzy, and I watched their scene, so I'd seen people be successful and deal with success and all that sort of stuff. So when it started to happen to us and I realized we were on a roll, you know, I remember specifically having a band meeting and us all saying, hey, look, fellas, this is it right now. So enjoy this, you know, because you only go from nowhere to everywhere once and you can't ever be nowhere again, you know, so enjoy it. It's going to be a kick.
All of its challenges.
Yeah, with all the challenges, exactly.
Has that been a problem for you? That measure of fame interfering with quality of life for you at any time?
It was for a while in the '80s. You know, I couldn't. Airports were a problem. You know, I couldn't go to a shopping mall without ramifications. You know, people and in those days it was autographs. Now it's photos. You know, I mean, that'd be a horrible time to be as popular as pick a celebrity. I mean, geez. Terrible. But my profile has diminished a little bit, which is nice. So I'm okay. I'm fine with it. I mean, I get there. It's a selfie thing. And now the country guys, they started this thing where after the show, you go out back of your bus and sign autographs for an hour and a half. I don't know where, you know, we never used to do that. And now the country guys do that. And now everybody's got to do that, you know, now. But it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything we haven't talked about in this conversation that you'd like to say?
Well, you know, I would make the point, right, that we are, that San Francisco, I'm going to say Bay Area, San Francisco, but this also applies to Marin in a way, because Marin is a segment Marin is a subset of Northern California, which is a subset of California, which is a subset of the country, subset of the world, you know. Mm-hmm. In terms of that, what's unique about Marin, in a way, is the diversity of influences that we've had. Like, even in San Francisco as well, in a sort of a grander sense. When you think back in the first 60s and so on, there was always talk of this San Francisco sound, this Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger, and I guess it was kind of a folky sound. It was, I mean, if you're trying to put your finger on it, it's probably, and the Sopwith Camels, and the, it was probably a little, the Moby Grape, I guess, you know, but it was kind of a folky, guitar-y kind of a thing, right? But, and then here comes the Sons of Champlin, and here comes Champlin, which is really kind of R&B music with all this stuff, with these new words, you know. I mean, Champlin really pushed the ball. And culturally, what we were out of our diversity, lyrics like I'm, you know, Aquarius, your birth sign, R&B music with birth signs in it. What? You know, this was created right here. This was came right out of this. This was a major musical thing. And probably the last major music. I mean, Tower of Power. Sly Stone created funk right here in the Bay Area by going to the Fillmore and seeing these diverse people together. You know, everybody is a star, different strokes for different folks. Bill Champlin, same thing. It just takes to match to start a little fire. It's not as bright as the light of your mind. If everybody would recognize their own desire, it might start moving up the spine. Turn it on. Turn on the lights in L.A., make it, you know, these kind of lyrics with R&B music. Sly created funk. I mean, Hendrix arguably created hard rock with a Bay Area influence, psychedelia, you know, boom, boom, boom. And all this came out of this. It was really the last musical revolution, if you will, but for rap. That's happened in the last, you know, 40 to 50 years, really. You know, you think about before the Grateful Dead, it was the Beatles, that love me do, you know I love you. And then these guys said, hey, we don't know where we're going. We're just going wham. And the Dead created the country western jam, really. It was kind of a little, it's really bluegrassy country western jam. Champlin's R&B, different, way different. The Sly's pure funk, all this stuff, but yet they had this common sensibility, which was, hey man, we're just going to let it go, you know. And that happened right here. Pretty cool.
I'm going to just ask, not tell, but you must feel sort of privileged to have been part of.
Yeah. Well, it was great. It was great. You know, we got to see shows at the Fillmore when we were kids that were unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. I never saw Jimi Hendrix, but my guys in my band did. For some reason, I never saw it. But I saw some shows there that were just unbelievable. And, you know, what does Fillmore hold? 800 people? Or 1,000 max. I don't think you put 1,000 people in there. And I mean, you know, people forget it was a very small little thing, you know.
So there was intimacy. There was absolutely a home feeling to it.
And something was going on there, man. That was the cutting edge. It was just brand new stuff, you know. Brand new stuff. We were watching that going, wow, that is cool. It was so impact that everybody wanted to be in a band. You know, and that's what you did. You got in a band with your nearest neighbors, you know, and there were just bands. Everybody was in a band.
It just inspired that.
Yeah.
It lit that fire. If you could describe a moment, just any moment, any time in your career or whatever, that just somehow stays with you, one of those magical moments that speaks to what you've experienced.
Or is there a moment, a magical moment?
An experience or a time, anything that set that comes to mind.
Well, you know, a lot of our big gigs come to mind, you know, where we had, you know, where we had a jam in Paris. We sold out the whatever it was, Bercy, I think it is, the big Enormo Dome in Paris, and Springsteen and Bob Geldof came by and jammed, and we had a jam at so I remember that night. We Are the World was an incredible night. The stories from We Are the World are myriad and wonderful. We've had so many career highlights. You know, we did Madison Square Garden like three or four nights in a row. We had, you know, the Forum in L.A. three nights in a row with all these great musicians who we idolized, showing up and saying how much they enjoyed our show and that kind of stuff. So that I've had in spades, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's the gratifying thing. I think of all the moments, it's the respect of your peers, you know. When you have people come up and say and really dig your music, you know, when people say nice things about you, and people who know, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. That is cool. Do you remember any particular people in Mill Valley that kind of embody that Mill Valley uniqueness and somehow stick in your memory?
Sure, Charlie Deal and the record store too. Did we talk about that? Did you get to talk about
help me. Oh my gosh.
Robin Pritzker's husband. Robin, who I went to school with, killing me here. You know who I mean.
Yes, I know. You're talking about the record store on Blythedale.
Yeah,
John Goddard's store.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember the name of it.
But Village Records.
Oh, Village Records. Mm-hmm. Village Music.
Village Music.
John Goddard and Village Music was like the best record store in the country. Mm-hmm. And he was a wonderful treasure to Mill Valley. Charlie Deal. What a character. Toilet Seat Charlie, who made the guitars out of toilet seats. And then would sit in and jam at gigs. You'd play a gig at the old mill or somewhere, and then Charlie would just get up and jam. He never plugged in or anything, so when nobody, I don't think anybody knew what he was really playing, but he'd be there.
He talked about it, though. You'd see him in town. Little guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
And he would talk about who he is, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd know everything that was going on, what bands were playing where. That was his thing.
Any other Mill Valley characters that stand out?
Well, yeah. Let's see. Let me think.
Do you remember White Jimi Hendrix? John Goddard talked about the white guy that dressed like Jimi Hendrix.
Oh.
And he'd come talk to Jimmy's poster every day.
But I remember there was a guy who dressed in a white suit all the time. We called him Man from Glad. You know, because he would just kind of, he was super handsome, and he would just kind of stand there at these events, and nobody knew what he did or who he was or anything. Didn't seem to come with anybody else. He'd just stand there in the back, and we just go, Man from Glad. Yeah, there were quite a few characters around during those times, you know. And then the hippies in the mid to late '60s were really, you know, something to behold.
Yeah, I think. It sounds like you had a nice time in Mill Valley while you were there.
Oh, I had a lovely time. I will always be a Mill Valley boy, you know. I mean, I was really, even though I moved there I didn't live there till I was five, but I lived there from five till, you know, what, 50.
You will always be one of Mill Valley's musical sons, Huey.
Cool.
Cool. Thank you so much.
You bet.
And on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, thank you so much for this interview, and have a wonderful show tonight.
Thanks, Deborah.